warm welcome to this podcast episode on cultivating connection in leadership and facilitation through the thinking environment. This podcast is brought to you by the International Academy of Leadership, known by all of you by its German acronym as the IAF. Based in the very quiet town of Gummersbach near Cologne, the Academy develops leaders working for partner organizations of the Friedrich Naumann Foundation for Freedom from all over the world, bringing together experts, opinion leaders, committed young liberals, and aspiring leaders to share specific experiences and knowledge, to develop themselves and their organizations, and to importantly explore liberal solutions and responses to public policy challenges. My name is Marika Groenewald, and in today's episode, we're exploring the thinking environment as a powerful enabler of independent thinking and authentic connection in leadership and facilitation. In this era that's marked by constant change and complexity, we've seen at the Academy and beyond how the thinking environment provides such a powerful counterbalance to the world we live in, creating a space and an environment in which each individual's thinking is valued, encouraged, and important for our progress as individuals, teams, and organizations, much like the space we're trying to create in Gummersbach. And in today's conversation, we'll explore why we believe it's so important at this time to cultivate a thinking environment, how we can do it from our closest relationships at home and at work to when we're acting as facilitators at meetings, gatherings, and events. We'll also look at the link between the thinking environment, the relationship between the thinking environment and liberalism, and how this powerful, incredible body of work can support us to bring about more freedom in our world. I'm very excited to be joined by my dear colleague and friend, Clinton Depriya, as co-host in today's conversation.
Hello. 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 Hi.
Welcome, Clinton.
I love that I went from colleague to friend.
It happens eventually.
What a bonus. Luckily for our listeners, it won't just be the two of us because we are joined by another dear colleague and more friend, I would say, Tricia Lord. Tricia is, I would say first and foremost, also an IAF facilitator. And we've spent many nights over a glass of wine here in Gummersbach talking about all things life. But Tricia comes with a wealth of experience, in particularly the thinking environment, which is why we're so happy to have her for this conversation. So a bit of background about Tricia. She is a faculty member of the thinking environment, so official in the world. But she's someone who has been studying and working with this body of work for close to two decades now. Tricia is a facilitator, a coach, a consultant, thankfully, and a founder of Braveheart Cultivating Courage. And she has more than 38 years of experience working in the fields of leadership development, organizational development, coaching, and facilitation, working with individuals, teams, and organizations around the world. Tricia, as a fellow IAF facilitator, it is wonderful to have you with us. Thank you for joining our conversation today.
Thank you, Clinton. Thank you, Marika. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So I actually am finding myself in Gummersbach at the moment. I am sitting in Room Popper. For those of you who have been here already, you'll know exactly where I find myself. And I think for many of those listening to this conversation who have been here, when we think about Gummersbach and the experience that we've had at the IAF, we do so with a real sense of longing to a wonderful time that we've had. So I want to start this conversation off with you, Tricia, by asking you, when you think of Gummersbach, what actually comes to mind for you?
Thanks, Clinton. It's really interesting, this question, because the first two words that come up for me when I think of Gummersbach is our home. That's the first word that comes up for me is home. And the second word is family. And I know I'm not the only person that thinks of the Academy in this way. I think that I've heard many people describe it as a home from home. And I was actually, when I thought about this question, I was actually remembering what it feels like to arrive at the front doors, you know, having sort of navigated the pickup schedule from the airport or the train station and finally arriving at the front doors and going through and being greeted by one of the women at reception. And it's always that feeling of, oh, welcome back. You know, there's just this incredible experience of, you know, funnily enough, even though you've left home to get there, of coming into a place which is, I think in some ways, a haven. It's a place where you know that you're going to be welcomed. It's a place where you know that you're going to be treated well. It's a place where you know that people are genuinely glad to see you and appreciative of what it is that you're bringing. And I think that's not just for us as facilitators, it's also for participants as well. So it's a place of a lot of connection, a lot of fun, and of course also learning and challenge and growth. So those are the things I think of when I think of Gummersbach.
Yeah. I mean, I can see, you know, we're all sitting here with smiles on our faces because I think we have a similar sense of home, which I think is not something that is created. I mean, it's not the building. It is the people that are here that create that sense of home and belonging and togetherness. And I think that that's also what the thinking environment in some essence creates for people. So if I can dive straight into the topic of the thinking environment, let me start with the most obvious question. Can you tell us in its very essence, what is the thinking environment? And I know that that is a difficult question because it is a body of work with books and this is a week-long seminar, but in its essence, Tricia, what is the thinking environment?
Well, actually, interesting, there's not a lot of questions that one gets in life, in my experience anyway, to which there is an answer. But there actually is an answer to this question. It then needs unpacking, as you said, because it is a body of work that's been developed over nearly 40 years now.
Wow.
But the answer to the question, what is the thinking environment in its essence, is that it's a way of being in the world. It's an invitation to be a particular way. So it comes out of a body of work which has a name, ontology, which is the study of being. And it's an invitation to notice the connection between the conditions that enable each person's independent thinking to flourish. And for me, that means each person's individual, unique self-expression to be invited to make itself known, to have its presence felt in the world, you know? So it's the invitation for that and noticing the connection between that and how we're treating each other, because that's what Nancy Klein, who's the original author of this understanding and this conversation called creating a thinking environment, what she noticed is that if we want to ensure that when people are with us, they are free to think for themselves, genuinely free to think for themselves, that experience that we sometimes have, and I mean, the three of us have it with each other, I think, which is that we're not second guessing ourselves when we're with each other. We're just being ourselves. We're just saying what we think and what we feel and what we want to say. We don't have to sit there worrying about how it's going to come across or, you know, whether it's going to be received. So that experience, you know, how do we create that experience for each other? And what she discovered, and it's really the most profound discovery, the more you unpack it and the more you work with it, is that what enables that experience is how we treat each other. And we know that, you know, you've both nodded your heads, because even though when people listen to this podcast, they'll only be hearing an audio, we can see each other at the moment. Whenever I say that in a workshop, you know, the quality of your thinking depends on how you're being treated by the people that you're with while you're thinking, inevitably people nod their heads. It's an automatic response to that statement. So in its essence, the thinking environment is a way of being in the world, and it's an exploration of what is that way of being and how do we presence it for each other. Yeah.
It's what always strikes me with the thinking environment is the simplicity of it and yet the profoundness of it. And I'm wondering, for those who have not come across it, could you perhaps just give us the 10 components that form part of the thinking environment, just like the headlines or the highlights of it, so that our listeners also know what we're talking about these 10 components?
Yes, absolutely. So if we go back to that statement, the thinking environment is a way of being in the world, then what is that way of being? If it's about how we treat each other, what are we talking about? So what Nancy Klein observed, and that's one of the things I love about the thinking environment, is that it is a body of work that is derived from observation. It's not an idea someone came up with and then set out to prove. It's something that she noticed over and over again. And I think that's one of the things that makes it really powerful. She paid attention when she was in the presence of people who were doing a good job of thinking well together, because you can tell, can't you, when you're with people and they are expressing themselves and they're free to express themselves. And you can tell when the thinking in a group is progressive and it's moving forward and it's innovative and inspiring. So she paid attention. What's going on here? And what she noticed was that there were this combination of ingredients, if you like, ways of being. And the thing that's fabulous about the 10 components is that each one of them is individually important, but they actually have this interconnecting relationship with each other. So they support each other, they call to each other. Without the others, each one can't survive. They're really like a family of ingredients. And what they are is attention, listening with genuine interest. And of course, if you are genuinely interested, then you promise not to interrupt. Because as soon as we interrupt each other, we've basically said, I've stopped being interested in you, and I'm now more interested in my own thinking. So listening with genuine interest, that's attention. Equality, giving everyone a turn and treating each other's thinking as mattering equally, despite the presence of hierarchy and power differentials, which there always are in any group. Ease, creating the conditions which enable us to discard internal urgency, which is something that we are infected by in the world in which we live, because it's not good for the quality of our thinking, basically. The reason why these ingredients are here is because of the impact they have on the quality of our thinking. So ease cultivates good thinking, urgency destroys it. Appreciation. So noticing what's good and saying it, the and saying it part is really important. Feelings, welcoming feelings, recognizing that the acknowledgement of feelings and the release of them is essential for us to be able to keep thinking well about things. Encouragement, which is one of my favorites, given the name of my business. Giving courage to the person that you're listening to go into the unexplored parts of their thinking, the places they haven't gone to yet. And in order for us to do that, we need to know that the person listening to us isn't judging us, isn't evaluating us, isn't analyzing, isn't interpreting. They just really want us to keep going. So that's encouragement. Information, we have to absorb the relevant facts for what we're thinking about. We have to recognize if we don't have them and do something about getting them. Difference, which is about recognizing the presence of untrue limiting assumptions that drive prejudice and doing everything that we can to eliminate those. staying interested even when we don't agree, when we don't see it the same way. That's the component of difference. Incisive questions, which are questions that surface and remove untrue limiting assumptions so that we can replace them with assumptions that are true and liberating instead. And then the component of place, which is created both by the physical environment that we're in, the room. Does it have enough light? Does it have enough air? Do we have enough water? Are our bodies taken care of? So all of those physical aspects of place, but also that we are the component of place for each other in the way that we treat each other. So the listener is also part of the component of place. I hope I mentioned all 10. I don't think I left any out. Yeah,
I think you did. And I think that is the most high-level executive summary I've ever heard of the thinking environment. Well done.
Thank you. I've been practicing.
Yeah. Before we dive into this, because you can hear the components and go, oh my goodness, okay, but what does that mean in practice? Before we get to that, I would just briefly like to know how you started with the thinking environment. What is your journey to the thinking environment? What does that look like? And why do you think it resonated so strongly with you that you dedicated so much of your career to exploring it and teaching it? And I would also say being it, actually, not just in session, but who I know you to be as a person. How did that journey start?
Thank you, Clinton. It started by being the odd one out in my family. So I had an absolutely wonderful mum and dad and a really wonderful brother and sister. I was the third born of the three of us. And I can remember right from when I was very little, looking at the four of them and thinking that they really fitted well together and that I somehow felt different. So I think it began with an experience of difference, actually. So fast forward from there, as a teenager, I remember being really fascinated by human beings, by being human, by this whole experience of being human. And also as a teenager, having very acute experiences of being on the outside looking in. You know, I wasn't one of the cool kids. And I longed to be one of them. And I explored, so I got very interested in exploring human nature right from my teenage years. And then I got interested in the world of personal development and I attended a whole bunch of workshops in my personal capacity. And that took me into the field of ontology because I started to work for an organization that ran personal development programs. And the question that was at the heart of their work was, what is the being of being human? You know, we talk about human beings. What are we talking about there? What's the being of being human? And then after 5 years of working for that organization, I set up my own coaching practice. And I worked as a coach in London for quite a few years, and then I fell in love, and then I fell pregnant. And after I had, my kids were born in fairly quick succession, there's only 18 months between them. After I went back to work, I had taken 4 years off work to be at home with my kids, which was a huge gift and blessing that I was able to do that. But then I was getting back to work and I was getting back to work in a new country, South Africa. I moved to South Africa to be near the four grandparents who were all living in South Africa. Once I had two kids under the age of two, they became an essential component to life. And here I was starting up my business again in a country where I had no network. So I decided to go and do a master's in coaching. And in the first year of that program, Time to Think by Nancy Klein was on the reading list. And I read it and I can remember reading it and I can remember going, this is it. That was the experience I had when I read the book. I was like, I was already 18 years into my career as a coach and a facilitator by then. But I was like, this is the thing that I've been looking for. So I did the first year of the master's, but I never went back for the second year because I found the only person in South Africa at the time who was teaching thinking environment programs and absolutely marvelous woman called Margaret Leadham, who sadly is no longer with us, but she was a huge freedom fighter. She was actually a member of the Black Sash and a huge freedom fighter in South Africa. She'd been exiled by the apartheid government and had met Nancy in the UK when she was living there and had brought Nancy's programs back to South Africa. So I did the Thinking Partnership, which at that time was the only course you could do. And I remember seeing the demonstration of the first thinking session in the Thinking Partnership course. I remember it like it was yesterday, and that was 20 years ago now.
Wow.
And I remember thinking, oh my goodness, this is the thing, this is the missing ingredient. Because, you know, in our field of facilitation and consultancy, there's a really insidious conspiracy going on, I think. And I think it's created by the medical model, myself personally. But that is that we are the experts in the lives of our clients, and that we're going to fix things for them. And it's a terrible trap to fall into, because it's not true. Mm. They're the experts in their own lives. And actually, our job is to release their expertise. And that's what this work does. And that's why I loved it so much. And I decided to dedicate the rest of my career to getting good at sharing it with people and teaching people and making it available to people.
Mm. Mm. That's beautiful. Yeah.
It's incredible what you've just said, Tricia, that awareness as a development professional and as a leadership practitioner, that they are the experts. They don't need a PowerPoint or advice or a good article actually to figure things out. What they perhaps most need is the environment to think for themselves about what it is they need, with some support, of course. And it's interesting, because I wonder then how much of our work as facilitators and even as leaders enabling teams is about supporting people to believe in themselves, that they can provide that for others, that is enough.
Mm.
I was thinking, as you were speaking about the ingredients or the 10 components, you know, if we had to bake a cake that represents the state of the world at the moment, and we were to put the ingredients of that cake together, it would probably not, for the most part, mirror the 10 components of a thinking environment. There isn't a whole lot of attention or equality or ease or appreciation going around. And there's a lot of data to back that up, that we live in a world that feels challenging, complex, volatile, vulnerable. We even have acronyms describing that world.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering, when you're out and about, and I know that you've done, I mean, the work at IAF, which covers, as we know, a lot of countries and enables a lot of interaction with different realities and contexts, but you've also done work in Eastern Europe, in the rest of Europe, in Brazil, in Africa, in South Africa. How is this met by people? Do they listen to the thinking environment and then consider their reality and almost go, this is not possible, this is not what I experience, this is a bit of a pipe dream? And how do you counter that? How do you support them to believe?
That's such a great question. Thank you. I mean, I think like anything that we are bringing to our clients and the organizations we work with, the individuals and teams we work with, and funnily enough, this is also true of liberalism, I think. A lot of the work that we share with people has got an aspirational or inspirational aspect to it. It is a reach,
yes.
You know, we're not, that's what we're inviting people to step into possibility, aren't we, in a lot of the work that we do.
Yes.
And I think you get met, and I know you experience this as well, both of you in the work that you do, you get met with a range of responses, don't you? And there's even theory about this, isn't there? Early adopters, and then I can't remember who comes after them. I think also because it's interesting because the thinking environment ultimately is a huge personal development journey. If you do decide to step in, because it's about how do we treat each other, one of the things that you're going to encounter if you take on working in a thinking environment and learning about it and deciding that you want that to be the culture of your relationships and the culture of your organization, and because it's about how are we going to be with each other, you know, who are we choosing to be? You're going to, each person is going to be confronted by the ways in which they are in their life that don't work, exactly as you've said. You know, we live in a world which, weirdly, I mean, actually, if you think about it, it's really slightly sort of concerning, if you think about it. Well, not even slightly concerning, mm-hmm. very concerning, that the world in which we live is constituted around ingredients that are almost the exact opposite. As you said, interruption, inequality, power struggles, massive urgency and crisis-driven ways of running our organizations. And that's just the internal environments that we're working with. If you look at the external environment, I mean, it's really crazy out there. So I think people do feel that it's a huge stretch, you know, when they first hear about the thinking environment. I notice there are some people who are hungry for it. That's their response. They're like, they're a little bit like I was when I read Time to Think. They were like, yes, I knew it. I knew there was a way that we could be with each other that was so much more functional than what we're doing at the moment. Hallelujah, I've found it. Hooray, let me in, you know?
Yes.
So there are those people, and you can see them. They just, you know, in my workshops, I just watch people falling in love, you know, literally falling in love with themselves, with everyone else in the room, with the work, with the possibility of what it's going to open up for them. And then there are people who are scared by it, confronted by it. I think because equality is one of the core ingredients of a thinking environment, in the same way as it is a core ingredient of liberalism as well, it's threatening, you know. It's threatening to the ego, it's threatening to those in power, or it can be. I mean, there are some people who are in power and they've recognized that the best thing that they can do with their power is to use it consciously and wisely, and they love the thinking environment.
Yeah,
because it gives them a framework for doing exactly what they know their power is for, which is to use it for the benefit of everyone around them. But if you're insecure, if you've got power and you're insecure about the power that you have, you're insecure about whether or not people think you deserve to have it, and therefore you're protective of it, then the thinking environment can be confronting. And then there are people who are skeptical but curious at the same time. So they kind of like, it's almost like they've believed in things in the past and then been disappointed by them, and they don't want to feel that again. You know, it's like a little bit like how we are when we feel like we're falling in love for the first time after a really bad breakup. And occasionally there are people that are cynical and downright resistant, you know. But actually, because of the way we run the workshops in the thinking environment, and because of, the, you know, it's very, very experiential. The learning journey has to be experiential. You can only talk about it for so long. You actually have to give people an experience of being in a thinking environment. And then pretty much people start to go, I like this, you know, this feels good. Even the people that are sort of a bit hard bitten and twice shy, you know, they kind of go, okay, this actually feels, this works. this actually works. And I think because of that, you get a lot of people who didn't think they were going to say yes to it, finding that they're coming round to it by the time the experience is, you know, by the time I'm saying goodbye to them and sending them off to practice.
Mm. Yeah.
So those are it's a range of experiences that I have in response to it. But I've been surprised, actually, in the 20 years nearly now that I've been teaching it and running programs, it's a very small handful of people who haven't seen the value of it. Actually, at the end of the day, it's been really, really rewarding.
Mm. And I think what you're saying just goes to, I mean, the underlying belief that we want the best for each other. Mm. We want the best for each other despite the state of the world. That is not, you know, the state of the world is not an accurate representation of the true state of the world and the state of people in the world. And the thinking environment represents, in a way, our ability to step into being something for each other where we can be at our best.
Can I actually just pop in? And I know that I shouldn't be doing this in a thinking environment.
No, please do.
I really love what you're saying there, because actually, the fundamental premise of a thinking environment is held in something we call the positive philosophical choice.
Exactly.
And it's very, very similar to oh no, I'm going to forget his name now. It'll come back to me. But, you know, the idea of unconditional positive regard, Carl Rogers, who was the father of humanist psychology. So Carl Rogers' idea of unconditional positive regard, and he actually really created a bit of a turnaround from the way in which people who had been trained by Freud and Jung approached being a therapist. And he said, actually, all your clients need, or your patients, as they're called in therapy, all they need is this unconditional positive regard for you to treat them like they are good and intelligent and capable and that they can get themselves better. And you treat them in that way and they will. And the thinking environment has a very similar thing called the positive philosophical choice, which began as the idea that we are inherently good, that human beings are inherently good. With the advent of more and more understanding through the field of neuroscience and psychology and the study of being, actually what we now know, and I mean, this is by no means a complete answer, is that actually at birth, human beings have the capacity for both good and bad, because a lot of people struggle to buy into the positive philosophical choice. You know, what do you mean human beings are fundamentally good? You can point your finger at any number of them around the world, some of them in terrifying positions of power, and say, I can't see much fundamental goodness there. Excuse me. And but actually, what neuroscience is telling us is that we're born with the capacity for both good and bad. But the human brain does not need bad in order to develop. It doesn't need any bad. So all of that kind of, you know, spare the rod and you spoil the child story isn't actually true. What the human brain needs in order to develop is only goodness. So even though we're born with the capacity for both, what we need is goodness in order for the brain to develop fully. And that's interesting, isn't it? The brain doesn't need any bad in order to develop fully. It only needs good. And so that does seem to suggest that we are more good than bad in nature, you know? Yeah, I just wanted to add that in.
I love what you've just said. It links so strongly to some interesting readings I've done recently about how the human brain keeps developing. Even well into older age, we can still recultivate new neural pathways. And it becomes harder, but it's entirely possible. And so, you know, if that statement that you've said is true, that the brain needs goodness, the word that you used, which I suppose includes things like encouragement, appreciation, validation, feeling equal, feeling respected.
Yeah.
The question really is, how can we as adults in our adult interaction with one another bring more of that? Because we don't need more of the flip side. We have a lot of criticism, a lot of unwarranted advice and feedback, unhelpful reflections, opinions, assessments, prejudice going around. The question really is, how do we bring balance to the world? How do we overpower this with what our brain needs to continue developing and thinking well for itself? And I think if you're listening to this conversation and you're wondering to yourself now, when do they get to the part of how do I do this? We are going to get there, don't worry. I have one more question, Tricia, that I want to ask before we delve a little bit into how do we create this at events and in our relationships. And it is a question that I suppose is an obvious one on a liberal podcast. Because it's always felt to me that the thinking environment is a deeply, inherently liberal, I don't want to call it methodology, body of work. I mean, it is fundamentally rooted in people's ability to think for themselves.
Mm.
And I know that most people listening to this conversation are in some way or another deeply attached to this idea of freedom and busy working with what we could call practifying ideology, whether it is through campaigns or policy papers or their work in media or trainings or whatever. Do you think liberals should care especially more than others, more than populists or communists, about, I'm being a bit facetious, about creating a thinking environment? Do you think there's a stronger link here, there's a stronger relationship here than perhaps with other political ideologies?
I think that there's a complete glove in hand fit between liberalism and the thinking environment. I mean, I think if you want your events, and I know that this is something that you want us to think about together, if you want your events to be liberal, running them as thinking environments, cultivating a thinking environment in the way in which you, and not just your events, but in the way in which you work with people in the organizational cultures that you create. It's almost like, you know, the interesting thing, I've heard this said by a number of people in different settings now in the 20 years I've been working with the thinking environment. It's almost as if the thinking environment is the how of so many other things. It's the how of Brené Brown's Dare to Lead. It's the how of, and I think it's the how of liberalism. I think it is the how. Okay, how do we be as liberals in the world? Because if you think about liberalism, I mean, the things that come to my mind, if I think about liberalism, first of all, is independent thinking, the right to think for yourself, the right to think for yourself, to think as yourself, because you can only think for yourself if you're thinking as yourself. So human rights, the freedom to make the choices that you're making about who you are in the world, and then the freedom to express that. I mean, that's at the core of liberalism. Equality is a, you know, fundamental principle of liberalism. And then I think of liberalism as liberation as well. You know, if you look at the history of liberalism, it's what replaced oppression, you know, as a political ideology. It was what replaced oppressive systems like monarchy and, you know, the ruling classes. So, you know, removing those oppressive systems and replacing it with, you know, the right to access to opportunities, regardless of who, you know, regardless of the circumstances of your birth. So all of those deep core values of liberalism are expressed in a thinking environment. You know, in a thinking environment, everyone gets a turn to say what they think, regardless of whether they are the boss or the person that's newest in the team. And when they say what they think, everyone else promises, A, to listen without interruption, and B, to be genuinely interested, and C, to treat that thinking as mattering equally to everyone else's. I mean, it's profoundly liberal. It's an expression of liberalism, the thinking environment. And it's a how-to. It's a how-to.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think.
Can we zoom in on that a bit? Because you've already started mentioning now a few practical things. I mean, everybody gets a chance to speak. The person with the power in the room does not necessarily matter more than others, or they have to be aware of their power. So if I conjure up the type of gatherings, meetings, workshops, programs that people who are listening to this podcast are in the business of organizing. And I think if we cast our eye to what we see in the world, as Marika said earlier, you know, it's very much the opposite of the thinking environment. We have stale boardrooms with a classic U shape, with the head of the meeting sitting in a very important position and a slightly higher chair. I mean, that's the kind of the obvious stuff, but then there's also these deeply ingrained anti-thinking environment behaviors that are sort of baked into the recipe of how we put gatherings and events and workshops together. And so if our call as liberals is to see the thinking environment as the way to give people the experience of thinking for themselves, the freedom of thinking for themselves and being in that environment, how do we counter this? How can those people who are responsible for putting those events and gatherings and programs together, who are in charge of transforming the status quo, how can they bring more of the thinking environment into their gatherings in a more practical sense? To get this experience of being valued as a free thinking individual.
Yes, I mean, you've hit the nail on the head, Clinton, in the way that you've asked the question, because it reminds me of that famous Maya Angelou quote: people won't remember what you said or what you did, but they will remember how you made them feel. And I think this takes me, I mean, I think if in answering your question, how do you get your events or your organizational cultures, the way you run your meetings, the way you do anything to be more of a thinking environment, the first thing that you do is you go to the fundamental observation that started this whole exploration of creating thinking environments in the world off, which was the observation Nancy Klein made, which is that the quality of everything we do depends on the quality of the thinking we do first. So if you want your events to be events where people get left feeling that their being there mattered to you, and that they leave with that feeling, it mattered that I was there, and the people that invited me to be there knew that I mattered. And therefore, they designed the event in a way that was going to leave me experiencing that by the time I left. The first thing you've got to do as the event convener, organizer, scripter of that event is you've got to think about it well first. You've got to think about it first. You and your team have got to think about what is the outcome? Why are we doing this? Why are we doing it? What is the outcome we want to produce by having this event? And if that's the outcome, so get really clear about that. And if that's the outcome, what is the thinking that we are inviting people to do in the event in order to produce that outcome? Who are these minds? You know, I like to think of every single person that walks into an experience with me is this is a human mind. You know, this is a human mind. It's one of the most extraordinary things on planet Earth. We still don't fully understand it. We're discovering new things about it all the time, and we still don't have the answer to what is consciousness. You know, I mean, here is a human mind coming into my presence. I am not going to waste it. I'm not going to treat it like a piece of machinery or a tick box exercise or a number. I'm going to treat it like the, you know, magnificent thing that it is. It's a human mind at work, and I'm going to create an environment for it to work well in. And then whilst it's here with me, I'm going to invite it to think for itself. And whilst it's thinking for itself, I'm going to make sure that that thinking is met by the thinking of everybody else in the room. And so that's how to think about your events in order to create a thinking environment, is what is the thinking that I want to have happen in this event? And if I'm inviting someone to be there, don't invite that person to be there and then not ask them what they think. That's rude. That's rude. You know, it's really rude.
A lot of rudeness going around in the world.
So, as you can tell, I feel quite passionate about this. And so then you have to think about it. Okay, well, so who's coming? And once they're there, what thinking do I want them to do? And how am I going to make sure that they get time to think, and that whilst their thinking is going to be treated like it matters? So then all the 10 components become your checklist. How do I, you know, the component of place suddenly takes on, you know, even though it's the 10th one on the list, it suddenly goes all the way up to the top. Because if the environment isn't, the physical environment isn't one that allows for people to connect, you know, connection is the blueprint of creating a thinking environment. We need to be able to look into each other's eyes. We need to be able to feel like we connect. I mean, this is one of the things that Gummersbach gets right, you know, is this experience of connection. So I need to create a physical environment where people can connect, and they're going to feel comfortable, and they're going to have regular breaks, and they're going to have lots of lovely, yummy, nourishing food, not just sweets, but nourishing food that helps their brains to work well, and that they get regular breaks during the course of the event, because we can't focus for longer than a certain amount of time before we need to have a break. And, you know, all of that sort of understanding and information needs to go into the way you design it. And then once people are there, you need good questions. And this is one of the exercises we've got in the thinking environment, which I absolutely love, which is, what's your topic or issue? What's the outcome you want by the time you're done talking about it? And what question would you need to ask people to get to that outcome? And if possible, you let people know what those questions are before they even arrive, so that they can already be thinking. You think about the information that they need in order to be able to think well about those questions, and get that to them ahead of time if possible, or you make it available to them in the session and do that in interesting ways. You're both really good at that, the two of you. You're really good at making information available to people in interesting ways.
Sometimes our clients would say too good at that.
and then you ask them what they think, and then you listen. You listen and you pay attention, and then you appreciate them. That's how you do it. Yes.
I want to jump in here, because I think Clinton and I have been thinking deeply, and we're geeking out a little bit now for the facilitators listening, or the event organizers. We've been thinking deeply about the art of questions, and questions and the role it plays in meetings, events, workshops, gatherings, and the role that it plays in facilitation is an underexplored body of work. You almost don't need much else if you're great at crafting a series of questions, and if you can put it in the right order. It is in itself a process. And this is a question that we didn't talk about before when we had a little chat about this podcast. What for you makes for a great question?
Well, that's a great question. I'd like to think about that for a minute. What makes a great question? I think, look, I mean, I think my answer to that is quite contextual. I think it does depend on the context, obviously. I think what I've just already mentioned, which is that I know why I've got you in the room. I know the purpose of what it is that I'm doing here. The why is bright and alive and aligned. And therefore, my inviting you to be part of this is because you have something to contribute to this why. You know, the reason you're here is because you have something to contribute. So I think one thing that makes a great question is that it allows you, whoever you are, who I've deliberately invited here, because of the contribution you can make to the why, it allows you to make your contribution. So it allows you to tap into your experience, your wisdom, your information, what it is that makes you a valuable participant in this gathering. It allows you to tap into that and respond from a place of value adding to whatever it is that we're here to do. So I think that's one way to ask good questions is to allow people to tap into their own experience and contribute what it is that they have to offer so that they feel valued and they feel purposeful in being there. But oh, it's such a great question, Marika. I mean, I'm sure that there are loads of other things that make for good questions. I think that one of the things that I learned early on in my career, way before I came to the thinking environment, is something which I've actually not done a lot of work on making this explicit in the work that I do, but it's lovely to have the opportunity to talk about it. It's this idea of speaking to the listening.
Can you
So
say a bit more about that?
it's recognizing that you've got people in front of you and they are already listening to something before they're listening to you. They're listening to themselves. And the more you can understand their listening, what matters to them, what shapes them, what's on their minds, what they need, the more you can understand that and you can ask questions that tap into their listening, I think that enables people to show up and to. And it also leaves people feeling seen. It leaves people feeling understood. Like you, oh, you, for you to have asked me that question, you'd have had to have understood something about what matters to me. That's a, you know, and I'm so glad you've asked that because it allows me to now speak to what matters to me and what's important to me. So I think that's also something that makes for a great question is that you understand the listening of the people in the room.
I love the way that you've put that, Trisha. It sounds to me like it's a bit like peeling away the layers of the onion. And it might mean that it's not just asking a question once, isn't it? It could be asking a number of questions related to one another so that you can get to what is going on below the surface, so that you can get to the listening that people carry in themselves. Because so much of our organizational life is about hiding things from each other. I mean, it's not as if we can go around in our teams and our organizations straight to the leader or the executive director and tell them, "You really annoyed me yesterday," or, "Wow, I feel very disenfranchised. I have no idea where we're going with this project," or, "I'm really deeply worried about the future of our organization." So it's almost as if we cultivate a habit in organizations of hiding so that we can cope and stay safe. And what the thinking environment does, and I think that's why it also encourages people to, think about what it is they want to do before they do it. And I love that you touched on thoughtfulness and thinking through the details. But it provides an opportunity for people to reveal some of what's really going on for them. Yeah.
Just to add to that, I mean, we've got this great question in the thinking environment. I know you know it well, which is, what are you assuming? You know, what are you assuming that makes you think XYZ, or what are you assuming that's stopping you from, or what are you assuming? And that's a very powerful question, because and it's linked to the component of incisive questions, because, and it speaks directly to what you've just been speaking about now, about the hiding, you know, how much is hidden, how much is unrevealed between us, and shaping the outcome. I mean, that's the tricky thing about the stuff that's hidden, is it's what's driving who we're being. We may not be saying it, but it's driving who we're being. So that question, what are you assuming, is a great question to, if we can cultivate environments where people feel free to talk about the assumptions that they're making, that would change the world.
Yeah, I'm, as you were talking, I'm thinking, you know, just how many of the gatherings that we see around the world are really done from the get-go with the participant in mind, with the minds of the participants in mind, you know? It's almost like it's just done from our perspective. So this listening to the listening of someone else, I think is just a practical, I mean, it's empathy, because empathy is about data. It is about understanding what the life is like for someone else. And if you don't have that information, if you don't know what they are, as you put it, listening to what their perspective is, then how on earth can you put something together that's going to make them feel like they matter? And it just, yeah, it makes me, on the one hand, it makes me depressed. And on the other hand, it also makes me incredibly excited, because if we don't see a lot of those gatherings, the bar is low to thrive and to succeed. If you can put something together where people have that experience, it will be transformative for them, and they will walk away going like, "Oh my goodness, that was amazing! Goosebumps! I must go back." So it's in a way it feels difficult, and yet it's also very simple.
Yes. The paradox.
Okay, if we can think about these events now that we're speaking about, and the way that we create this thinking environment, if we can zoom out and look at the broader context within which these gatherings are taking place. So let's imagine you are trying your best and you're delivering amazing gatherings where people do feel that they matter, and you know, their brains are marveled at when they walk into the door. I think the context of the moment that we find ourselves in, and my moment, I mean the last decade or so, probably, we've seen an uptick in people using the differences that we have between us, using it almost as a weapon to divide and conquer. Politicians do this. And I know you mentioned difference as one of the components of the thinking environment. So I'm wondering, if difference is being used in the context of political leadership and political campaigns across the world, and politicians are playing and speaking to this difference or the diversity as a bad thing, as it's something that should be eradicated, and it makes people pull into their own lager, as it were, their own little groups, us versus them. But in the thinking environment, difference is encouraged. It's not seen as something to be avoided or feared. It's actually seen, as you said, it's something that is necessary. It is what brings reality into the conversation. It improves our thinking. So I was wondering if you could share a bit more of your thoughts about that. About how difference in this context plays into it, which I know is no small question. Can you please solve global challenges for us in this podcast?
Well, if we keep going long enough.
Yes. Well, you actually hit the nail on the head in the way you were phrasing the question, Clinton, because difference is reality. You know, reality is diverse. And the mind thinks best in the presence of reality. The human mind think, you know, the more, which is why the component of information is so important, you know, gathering all the relevant facts in terms of what it is that you're focusing on and thinking about. Appreciation is another one of the components that speaks to this thing of get the best picture of reality as you can in front of you in order to be able to do the best thinking that you can do about whatever it is that you're thinking about. The component of appreciation, which is notice what's good and saying it, because even in the worst of circumstances, there will be good things. And the more we notice them and say them, the better able we will be to think about the tough stuff. So difference is another one of these reality tuning components, because life is made up of difference. I'm actually a bit baffled, to be honest with you, by the concept of sameness. I don't know. I don't quite know how we came up with it in the first place, because I've tried looking for it and I can't find it anywhere. you know, what the whole of life is made up of difference. So intelligence requires difference. The minute we start getting involved in things that aren't real, we become stupid. And so this idea of homogeneity is very stupid making, because it doesn't exist. It's not real. I think the reason why we've got so much of it going on in the world at the moment, and it's on the increase, this particular form of stupidity, is because we're frightened. You know, we're living in a frightening world at the moment. There's an vast amount of instability and uncertainty. And the more frightened we become, it's almost as if the more we then cling to what feels familiar. And people that are more like us feels familiar. So I think the component of difference is a very challenging component of the thinking environment, because our brains are not hardwired for it, unfortunately. Our brains are hardwired to look for what's familiar and therefore feels more safe. So I think that's why it's on the rise at the moment and has been for some time, because the more instability and the more uncertainty we're surrounded by, the more we start looking for what's going to make us feel safe. And that kind of, it's a shortcut. It's a sort of shortcut to safety, to surround us by people that are more like us or just like us or seem to be just like us. I mean, of course, the minute you scratch the surface, you're going to find they're not. You know, you can sit in a room full of, you know, people who look just like you, are the same age as you, come from the same race as you, do the same job as you. But the minute you start scratching the surface, you're going to discover that they actually identify with a whole host of things that you don't identify with. So did you want to add something?
No. Go on. I'm listening.
Okay. So
this is my interested face.
I know. Yeah. I think the thing about the component of difference is an invitation to growing up. I think we need to grow up in order to get good at difference. We need to, for some reason, this hardly ever happens to me, but a biblical quote has just come into my mind. It's kind of like that one, when I was a child, I thought like a child, I spoke like a child. That one, it's very famous. I can't remember which book it comes from, but anyway, now that I'm a man, I'm sure it would have said now that I'm a man, because, you know, the Bible's very gendered in that way. But I've set aside childhood things, the quote goes on to. And I think that's what we have to do in order to get good at the component of difference. We have to set aside that sort of fantasy wish that everyone could be just like me and we can all get along together. It's not real. We're different from one another, and we see things differently, and we think different things matter in different ways, and we prioritize things differently. And the better we get at being good at that and about being unafraid of that, the more realistic that we're going to be and the more intelligent that we're going to be and the more we're going to come up with solutions to these very challenging, unsettling, destabilizing problems that we've got going on in the world. We're going to get better and better at solving those if we can gather in the diverse points of view, because the diversity is all around us. And if we try and come up with a homogenous solution, it's not going to work in the world.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not
situated
in. I don't
know if I've answered your question, but that's what
I have.
Think.
You have. You. I mean, essentially, you've highlighted the importance of diversity and of difference as we've met, and almost a pipe dream of looking for sameness. I love that. And if I can draw a quote out of this, it is, you know, people need to grow up dealing with difference. If you are a leader. Maybe you've seen this, or you've taught this to leaders specifically who are facilitating gatherings where difference perhaps is present, or it jumps out of them in a heated conversation. How do you perhaps personally deal with difference, differing opinions, where people get heated? You know, feelings are now at play. Thinking has gone out the window, because we are now disagreeing on a very important thing, and we hold on to these beliefs and opinions like it's the last thing we're ever going to deliver that's good in this world. And now you find yourself as a leader in this conversation. So how do you restore the thinking environment with this component of difference then in when it takes over or it removes the thinking? I don't know if that's even, I don't know, paradigmatically correct saying, but I have this scene in my head playing out of two people going at it in a meeting and just disagreeing with each other, and the leader thinking, oh my goodness, there goes the thinking environment. What would Trisha do? So yeah. Trisha, what would Trisha do if we can stay with the biblical theme?
Well, it's interesting, actually, the scenario that you've just described, Clinton, and something that I said right at the start of our conversation, which is about how the components support each other. And it's kind of like each component needs the other ones to stay steady, because if they start to fragment, and if someone doesn't pull it back, the whole thing will start to fragment. And if you've got two people going at each other, probably what you don't have any longer is attention or equality anymore. So if you can reestablish the agreements around that, I think one of the things that people really need to grasp, if they are interested in a thinking environment and they're serious about wanting to create thinking environments in their world, is they need to grasp that it is a contract. It's an agreement that we're making. So we're saying to one another, we want to treat each other in a particular way. And that way of treating each other includes these agreements. I will not interrupt you. I won't hog all the time. I'll make sure that we, you know, that we're equal in the amount of time that we have to think, and so on and so forth. So when difference raises its head, and the reaction that it gets from someone else is the feeling of being made wrong. You see, the thing about difference is it's huge inner work. To get good at difference is big inner work. I need to start to understand, what is it that I'm afraid of? You know, what am I afraid of? That this person is going to show me up, that I'm about to find out that I've been wrong in the way that I've been thinking about this, and that there's actually a better or closer to reality or more accurate or more useful way to be thinking about this. And what is it about my ego and my identity that is so afraid of that? You know, we've got an expression in the thinking environment faculty, which is, yay, I was wrong. It's one of the things that we seek to
cultivate.
That's
fabulous.
Yeah. And we've got this beautiful distinction which Nancy Klein came up with, which is to be an expert explorer. So to be as interested in what I'm about to find out, which might mean that everything that I thought was the case up until this point isn't the case anymore. To be as good as I possibly can be at the stuff that I know, but at the same time, to be as interested, if not more so, about what I don't know and don't even know I don't know, the knowing of which could transform everything that I currently know. So I think leaders need to cultivate that way of being. To be a leader, I think you need to be a yay, I'm wrong person. You know, yay, I was wrong. My goodness, we've discovered something better. Hallelujah. You know, rather than, no, I wasn't wrong and I'm going to hang on to my point of view and I'm going to make anybody that doesn't agree with it bad and wrong and I'm going to get rid of them. That's not leadership. That's not leadership.
Yeah.
That's what I think.
I wish I could print that on a banner and fly a small plane across the world. Yay, I was wrong.
Yeah, it's fantastic because I think, I mean, that to me encapsulates liberal leadership. Liberals are interested in finding new, better, more innovative solutions for the sake of humankind. We're interested in everybody bringing their ideas. So the yay, I was wrong slogan, Clinton, might be a good idea for the IAF, for a t-shirt range for our participants.
Making a note.
The place where I find it hardest to go, yay, I was wrong, is at home. What I haven't said is that I also teach the thinking environment as a facilitator. And very often when participants leave the room, I say, you know, my homework to you is go and maintain a thinking environment tonight with your family. And I think that really is one of the most challenging places to be a thinking environment, because we, in brackets, think we, close brackets, know it so well. And so it's easy when we have our personal relationships or our close relationships, and maybe we can extend those to colleagues that we're close with, fellow leaders that we know, where somebody says something, and even though you're not interrupting them, in your mind, what you're thinking is, oh, here we go again. I've heard this before. Wonder how long it's going to take tonight to work through the full cycle. I mean, how do we get ourselves out of that in our relationships? Because, of course, when I'm saying this, I can hear how it keeps you trapped in a certain conversation, and it just perpetuates the same thing. The listener being slightly annoyed, rolling their eyes, whether externally or internally, and the person that's busy thinking or speaking, feeling unheard, unvalidated, also stuck in a certain groove. So is there a way, very practically, Tricia, in which we break that cycle so that we can become better listeners for the people close to us?
You know, so much I'm realizing in this conversation that I've been in with the two of you, so much of what enables us to sustain a thinking environment in our lives does depend on the work that we're willing to do on ourselves as human beings, and you know, recognizing the places where we are, you know, frail and prone to psychological insecurity, and deciding to do something about that as opposed to just expecting everybody in our lives to put up with it. So I think if I answer your question from a very practical perspective, I just want to tell a little story. My husband Michael was in the habit of walking through the door at the end of his day, already downloading how his day had been as he walked through the door. So the front door would open and this download would be happening. It would walk in, happening already. And I would be inevitably in, you know, caught between trying to get, you know, trying to let go of my day, get supper on the go, and deal with, I'm talking some time ago now when the kids were little, to, you know, little ones, both competing for my attention or, you know, in the process of trying to murder one another or whatever it might have been, you know, so, and it took, and I would get very, very irritated by now this other needy person arriving, needing my time, my attention, you know, and not apparently having any insight into the fact that my time and attention was otherwise occupied by other things before he got there. And this really interesting thing, I finally figured it out, not without a lot of annoyance and irritation happening first, but I did finally figure it out. And that was to actually, and he knew about the thinking environment, he'd done a program with me, but was to actually say, I need to know what it is that you want from me when you are talking about your day. Do you just want me to listen? Do you want my input? If you just want me to listen, can we decide what's a good length of time for that? Like, how long would it be helpful for you when you come home for me to be ready to just sit and listen? And we need to take into account the other practicalities of what will be going on at that time of day. And is this going to be something where at the end of you telling me all about the day and my having listened to it, you're going to want to know what I think? In which case, at some point, you need to stop your turn and ask me what I think. And then when I'm telling you what I think, I would like you to also listen without interrupting me, because I will have been listening to you without interrupting you. I know that sounds very much like running a workshop in your own home, and it is a little bit, but it really worked. It really made a huge difference, because sometimes he did want to know what I thought and sometimes he didn't. And just having that distinction was really, really helpful. And even to this day, and we're actually separated now, sadly, but even to this day, he will say to me, because we're still obviously co-parenting our kids, he will say to me, I need to talk to you about something and I just want you to listen. And then I know. And then I say, okay, have you got any idea roughly how long it's going to take? And he has to think about that. And he said, no, it's going to take me about 5 minutes, or it's going to take me about 10 minutes. And I don't put a timer on. I'm not quite that bad. But but he's said, he's already agreed the length of time it's going to take. So he's got that in mind now. And I know he's got that in mind. And that's incredibly helpful, you know, because if we know that the other person is aware of the length of time that they're taking, and it's not just going to go on ad infinitum, then the component of equality is a little bit more intact. You know, so it's little things like that. I think you have to understand that in order to create a thinking environment, you need agreements and you need boundaries. They're part of the component of equality. And without them, it does get difficult to listen and to just feel as if your attention is just expected of you, and you've got no idea whether the other person is cognizant of the fact that it's expected elsewhere as well. So I do think we have to kind of grow up a little bit in our home relationships as well, and say, okay, well, if this is what you expect of me, then this is what I need in return, and kind of set those agreements up. I think if the person knows that the reason you're doing it is because you want to be able to listen to them with genuine interest, then they'll go along with it. I don't know. What do you think?
I think you need to come over to my family and just come and join a dinner with no ulterior motives.
Do some facilitation.
Please.
I'm keeping an eye on time. And so before I ask you our last question, Tricia, I'm sure that people listening to this conversation have felt that it's gone in rich territories. I mean, we've gone through what is the thinking environment, why is it applicable to liberalism, the state of the world, how can you do this at events, personal relationships, personal leadership. Where can people find you if they want to learn more?
Thank you. So I have a profile on LinkedIn. In fact, I think there's a personal profile, Tricia Lord, and there's also a Braveheart profile. I'm on Facebook, similarly, Tricia Lord and Braveheart. There's two different pages. And I have a website, which is www.braveheartlife.co.za. And I've got a YouTube channel, Tricia Lord. And there's some neat little videos on the YouTube channel, all sorts of things about a thinking environment. So if people are actually interested from the podcast to try it out and apply it, there's lots of little how-to videos, how to do rounds, how to craft questions, how to do thinking pairs. So there's a lot of useful stuff on the YouTube channel, and also then just some of my musings about the things that interest me in life. Yeah.
Fantastic.
And if people are keen, they can also sign up for my newsletter, which goes out once a month. So they can just email us at admin@braveheartlife.co.za and ask to join the newsletter.
Wonderful. And speaking of writing, do you have some books that you want to or can recommend to our audience that you love or that you find particularly helpful?
Yes, we had a little bit of a giggle about this, didn't we, at the start before we started the recording, because I came up with a library's worth of books. I'm going to reduce it down to the key ones at the moment. I mean, there's so many, but I loved Waking Up by Sam Harris. Anything by Mark Nepo, N-E-P-O, Mark Nepo, but I particularly loved, because it's to do with courage, Facing the Lion, Being the Lion. I read this years ago, but it was such an impactful book for me. Joe Jaworski, Synchronicity. And Humankind by Rutger Bregman, absolutely fabulous research and very consistent with the positive philosophical choice. Brilliant book. Creating Freedom by Raul Martinez. I think that's a must read, particularly for liberals. And then finally, just for something a little bit different, The Boy, The Mole, The Fox and The Horse by Charlie Maxey. It's just such a beautiful book about being human. Mm. Yeah.
Beautiful book and a fantastic list. Thank you for that. I'm deeply interested to hear the expanded one, but maybe we save that for a next podcast conversation. Tricia, I want to thank you for joining us, for having joined us today in conversation. I want to appreciate your clarity and wisdom and connection. It's been such a pleasure having you in this conversation and exploring this topic with you, which feels like it really does not only have the potential, but is making the world a better place. Thank you very much on behalf of everybody listening and Clinton and I for being in conversation with us.
Yeah. Well, thank you to you too. It's been wonderful. And to anybody from Gummersbach who's listening, if you're someone who's been in a seminar with me, greetings to you in particular. And yeah, thank you for the opportunity to talk about something that I, as you know, love. And it's been great fun to be with the two of you. And thanks for the great questions. Talk about good questions. You did a really brilliant job. Thanks.
Thank you. This episode has formed part of the IAF podcast series, which is an accompaniment to the regular seminar programs that's offered by the International Academy for Leadership in Gummersbach. We want to invite you to listen and enjoy all the other episodes and conversations with amazing experts. Please do share your thoughts and response. You can use the IAF's various social media channels to do that. And if you want to connect with us, you can also find the details on the social media channels. Till next time, we look forward to chatting to you again. Bye.
Bye.